Kia ora and welcome to Workers' Voice. Spend the next hour with us as we discuss the tribulations and triumphs of building workers' rights and increasing fairness in the workplace. This show is produced by Unite Union.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Workers' Voice. I'm your host, Joe Curran, Senior Organiser with Unite Union. And today I'm joined by John Crocker.
Good morning, Joe.
And John, what's your role?
I'm an industrial officer part-time at the union, just wrapping up a law degree.
Excellent.
In November, actually. Looking forward to it.
And it was your birthday on Bastille Day.
Bastille Day, yes. I'm a child of the revolution.
Oh, young. Excellent. Well, that was one good party.
I'm glad you're
That's
great.
The kind of party the working class need, eh?
Yeah, definitely.
Excellent.
With fun.
In the centre is Mike Treen. Mike.
Kia ora, Joe.
How's your month been?
I've had a very interesting month.
Some developments happened in the last month or two, eh?
Yeah, a lot happening here and around the world. It's getting interesting, I think, in politics, or a little more interesting.
Do you think people are reading your blogs and paying attention?
Oh, they should. They should. I hope they do. But I despair sometimes, but then again, you know,
lastly,
we can't give up.
Lastly, on the extreme left here, Shirley Wang. Shirley, how have you been?
I've been great, Joe.
We've got some important deadlines coming up in August, eh? For migrant workers.
Yeah, important deadlines, actually.
Okay, so Shirley's going to talk about that. Right, well, first off, we're going to look at some of those developments. Some of the parties had their conferences over the weekend, New Zealand First and the Green Party. Mike, did you see anything interesting in those?
Well, there were two things, I think. One is the Green Party came out with a more positive policy around income support than I was expecting. So that's a plus. That they get. If there is a change of government, the Greens, it would require the Greens and Labor to form a coalition. Labor announced their policies a few weeks ago around welfare and income support, and it was very modest in their ambitions, I must admit. And the Greens have a stronger ambition in that regard. So they want to raise the minimum wage immediately to $17.50, I think, versus
$17.75.
$17.75, even better, and take it to two-thirds of the average wage by 2020. So that's a pretty strict timetable, whereas Labor wants a minimum wage going up to $16.50, which is a little better than now, but will go to a minimum wage being two-thirds of the average wage when economic conditions permit, however long that may be. So that's a little vaguer. So they're stronger from the Greens.
Now, as well as the wages, they also announced some changes to the way WINS sanction people, and you know, the kind of draconian regime there if you get a little bit of extra work and stuff like that. Have you got any details on that?
It's going to make it easier to work part-time. It's also, there are going to be fewer sanctions. There are going to be fewer penalties involved for accessing a benefit. The WINS regime over the last, it actually started even before this government came in the last year or two of the Labor government, but they have been very, very restrictive in their application of policy, which has actually meant that there are today 100,000 fewer people on welfare than would normally be the case with the current levels of unemployment. So they've just driven people off. And that's why I think we've seen a rise in food banks and homelessness and so on. So the Greens are tackling this head on, saying they've got to end the sanctions regime. They're going to lift the rate of benefits. And I think that that is a good start for trying to turn a culture, a brutal and penalty-driven culture that ends up in inhuman policies being imposed. Actually, that's driven people who are receiving benefits driven them to suicide,
yeah,
and despair, and it's got to end. Yeah. And I think the Greens are saying that they're going to stand up, and I think that that's a positive, definite positive.
Me and Shirley went to see that film, I, Daniel Blake, which was all about an older worker who then is made redundant and has to rely on the benefits that he's paid his tax for all his life, and there's that whole culture of humiliation and stuff, eh, Shirley?
Yeah.
I see Materia, though, has kind of come out quite bravely and said that, you know, as a younger person, you know, reliant on benefits and stuff, she might have told some mistruths to get through their crazy system of, you know, what is it, 23 pages to apply for some support. Do you think other politicians who were young women, you know, in their 20s should also come forward and tell the truth?
Well, I think that would be great if we saw it. I mean, just doing the rounds on social media is, I believe, a letter that she wrote to the media, the Herald perhaps, of her own experiences under the previous national government while on a benefit. So I think it's been good that that's been out there. I don't know if we'll see her come out further at this point as Deputy Prime Minister to admit wrongdoing, but we can hope. It'd spice things up.
But do you really blame people for, you know, lying on those applications? No, you can't really blame people.
Yeah, well, there's lying, or what is it, like 26 or 27 pages we saw?
No, it's nuts. Now it's completely ridiculous what the hoops they expect people to come to jump through. And, you know, I've had a mother in tears with me because they were insisting that her son bring in a birth certificate, which they had a copy of since the son had been on. You know, she'd been a sole parent and the son was sort of 16 and left home, and now the son needed to get a benefit, so he needed to bring in another birth certificate. They had to pay for another one. And they were just doing it just to be arses, really, because they already had the information that they needed, and when she got a bit shooty about it, they just stopped the benefits.
Well, the other thing the capitalist says, we live in a free society, we don't live in one of those dictatorships like Eastern Germany where you've got the Stasi, you know, inquiry and snooping into your private affairs. And yet when you look at this country when it comes to the definition of a de facto relationship, you've got these bureaucrats, you know, sniffing around people's bedrooms.
This we live in the system of having a system that's based on entitlements which reduce depending on the type of relationship you're in is actually very 19th century. People move in and out of relationships all the time. People's gender is much less strictly defined. Much less strictly defined as in a binary character today. And the type of relationships people have are much more fluid. So it's almost impossible to impose or force people into this strict binary regime, and it encourages people to break the law or encourages the breakup of families because it encourages families, parents to live apart. In order that one is able to access a sole parent benefit while the other may be working on minimum wage, but if they were living together, the combined income through working for families would be significantly less. So they're actually encouraging breakups of families rather than being family first, as they often claim. They're actually family destroyers, in my view.
So some good policy from the Greens coming forward with this, like reducing the sanctions and kind of changing that kind of culture so it's one of support rather than of humiliation. Anything else you saw good in there, John, Shirley?
Hardly had a chance to look, but I think the minimum wage movement is the other part that jumped out to me. Labor's was lackluster, 75 cents. I mean, if we're going to wait till April, that's only a quarter of a dollar more than what the current government has been regularly increasing it. So to see some real movement on that, 1775 is a good start, and some firm commitment. One thing that really annoyed me about Labor's position was that the caveat, when economic conditions allow. And it's this very outmoded style of thinking around the minimum wage, that it somehow puts pressure on jobs. And what we've seen coming out of the United States is some very good data, particularly from Seattle.
Where you mean the socialist hellhole of Seattle?
Yes. I think it burned to the ground, but they've rebuilt it from the ashes since their minimum wage riots. Obviously being a little ironic there.
Apes together strong.
Yeah. But what we're seeing is that raising the minimum wage generates jobs. I think the Treasury needs to relook at those presumptions that it's based that old report on, and people need to rethink that. It's stimulatory. The economic conditions exist once you put the minimum wage up. It's self-generating, and it's very good to see.
I think the other thing that we need to take note of, which is a little bit more dangerous, is the New Zealand First announcement that they will demand a mandatory referendum or a binding referendum on the issue of 100 MPs and the abolition of the Māori seats. This puts him on the path of forming a government with National, not with Labour. So don't let anybody be confused in this regard, that Winston Peters and New Zealand First are somehow an anti-establishment party or are somehow not willing or able to form a government with National. He has said that that's a bottom line issue for him. It's going to be hard to resile from that, bottom line thing. And I find it almost impossible to believe that a Labour Greens government is going to support or allow a referendum on the issue of the or a binding referendum on the issue of the abolition of the Māori seats. Mm. It's actually unfortunate in New Zealand society today and the reduction of the seats to 100, the reduction of seats. People would probably vote in favour of both of those, and I think probably mistakenly. The system of proportional representation we have is a difficult one to do with 100 or less seats, but that's just a sort of a technical issue. But Winston knows
less representation for smaller parties within.
Yeah. Well, that's the issue: is how to maintain the sort of proportional sort of system and electorates. You see, in New Zealand, we've got a combination of electorate seats and proportional seats. Mm. If you had 100 seats and it was just strictly proportional, then it might be possible to have 1%. One seat. I wouldn't necessarily be opposed to that, but the current system where you have a comp, which I think is what people voted for, and so therefore what people wanted was a combination of electorate seats and list seats is needs a bigger parliament and not a bigger sort of whatever they've got at the moment, 60 something electorate MPs, and then a combination to build it up to make it proportional. And the other one is the abolition of the Māori seats. Officially, the National Party
kind of Hobson's Pledge kind of
stuff.
Well, that's Brash, right?
Well, that's the Brash's little campaign, right? And the National Party, on a formal level, is in favour of the abolition of Māori seats. So it's an easier thing for them to say, well, right, we're going to have a vote on it, a mandatory vote on it. They've backed off doing it because, as John Key said in the past, there'd be riots in the streets, there'd be protests up and down the country if they tried to do that, and that will happen, and it will be extraordinarily polarising. And I think it's actually wrong for the sort of Pākehā majority to impose that on the Māori minority. When those seats, and if those seats are ever abolished, it has to be done by an agreement, not by simple majority rule. We have an agreement between two parties, in a sense, and through the Treaty of Waitangi, and it was when these seats were established. And remember, when these seats were established, Māori were probably the majority of the country. So they were given seats as a way of disenfranchising them rather than enfranchising them, and sort of bringing them into the system, which but with much less representation than they should have had, mm-hmm. and under a one-person, one-vote system. We didn't have a one-person, one-vote system, say. So they, anyway, they're cobbling together this undemocratic...
The days before they let poor people vote. Quite right, too.
So Māori, who were, I don't know what exactly the percentage, but, you know, at least half the population, weren't property owners and didn't have electoral rights under the old parliamentary system where you needed to be a property owner. So they gave these electorates to Māori as a way of bringing them into the system and allowing representation. But these seats have become part of the relationship between Māori and the dominant nationality, and Māori have seen them as a mechanism for protecting their rights and interests. Taking them away in a unilateral manner, even if you can win a vote on it, is actually not a democratic thing to do. And I think, and the problem here now is that Labour and the Greens, who were hoping New Zealand First would give them some support in the formation of a coalition government, are going to find it very hard to do so. Which will then give the excuse to Winston Peters to say, I'm going with National because National are more likely to allow a binding referendum on these issues.
Mm. So the game's kind of changing over the weekend, eh? Mm. Yeah, the Greens kind of moved more to the left. Because I think there was some criticisms there, you know. I mean, them signing up for fiscal responsibility places them, you know.
That is just stupid. You see, this Labour and the Greens signing a fiscal responsibility pact is simply economic stupidity. It's not. There is no economic sense in that at all, right? It is simply an ideological thing that they are saying to. They're telling the establishment essentially. They're telling the economics profession, they're telling the wealthy, they're telling the owners of industry and business that we won't run a government
ambitious like Jeremy Corbyn's.
Yeah, that is the least bit ambitious. That actually tries to challenge things. So, and not only do they have a sort of a fiscal responsibility around budget deficits on average and so on, they actually have something which is just voodoo science, which is that we will not increase the size of the state in the economy beyond 30%. Mm. Now, it's 40% on average throughout Europe, and it hasn't collapsed, right? That's 50% in countries in Scandinavia, and the world doesn't come to an end. 30% is not science, it is religion. Mm-hmm. It is religion, and the adoption of this by Labour and the Greens is simply a signal that they will bow down before the ruling class and its religious professors who are in the economics profession.
In your blog, Don't Mourn Organised, Mike, you talk about this.
I try. It's in the daily blog. I try to write on some things weekly if I can. But this week was on this issue that the left, that there is a bit of a gap in terms of the left discourse getting a real airing in this election. So the Greens tacked a little bit back to the left around welfare and income, but a little bit easy for them to do on that issue because it's they know that they're going to be a minority in the next government and they can kind of be negotiating with Labour. But that's a good thing, and I congratulate them on them. But their prior acceptance...
Going to tax the rich as well, isn't it?
Yeah. Very modest, you know, 40, you know, very modest, but still, that's a good thing. And I think that their tax proposal is simpler and more understandable than Labour's. Labour's got themselves tied into allowing the government to manoeuvre them into opposing the government's tax cuts without an alternative, whereas at least the Greens have got an alternative. So they're going to reduce taxes on a lot of low-income people and increase it for those on 150,000. That's simple and understandable. And those are the sort of things that Labour could and should be doing and that Corbyn did on that tax stuff. He came with very simple things. He said 90% of people will pay less tax. 10% will pay more and corporates will pay more. You keep it simple. You keep the message simple. Labour's got itself in saying that we're opposed We're opposed to tax cuts on working people, which doesn't make, you know, which a lot of working people go, oh, that doesn't make sense to me, yeah. Right? So they...
Tax the rich and leave us alone.
Yeah. that's actually what a left-wing program is.
Exactly.
Working people are overtaxed in this country. Absolutely. You know, and on average around the world. We've got the GST, we've got the sin taxes on our tobacco and our petrol and our alcohol and all the rest of it. Yeah. You've got all those sort of things. And plus you've got
the
quite a high minimum income tax of whatever it's
called. PAYE, yeah, working people. All right, look, we might take a wee song here. This is Star by Primal Scream.
We'll be right back.
Well, one of the darker, I suppose, parts of the election campaign so far has been the use of migrants as a scapegoat. And I'm joined by Shirley Wang, who plays a leading part in the Migrant Workers Association and the recently formed Chinese Workers Association. Shirley, you've been doing a lot with Sea Unite in unionising Asian and Chinese workers in one of the biggest workplaces in New Zealand, in Sky City. But you've been seeing the effects of the changes that have been proposed for August with workers. Can you talk us through some of that?
So I guess one of the biggest, I guess it's now becoming like a fear in a lot of people that I'm not going to be here anymore, that my job is, my life is literally on the line. A couple of weeks ago, I was talking to a guy in Christchurch, and I can see Sky burst into tears because, you know, he's given up everything back home to be in this country, to make a new life for him and his wife. Play by the rules, anything your New Zealand government asked him to do, he actually did it. I thought he was being a lawful citizen, but now when the new law comes, he's going to be deported. There is no future for him back at home. There is no future for him in New Zealand. Where does these people going to go? And I guess that's a lot of, it's a question on a lot of people who are actually affected by this issue. What about me? What will happen to me? Because they were given this false promise that come to New Zealand, you'll be given a residency and going into citizenship in a country, build a better future. They paint a really nice picture in a fantasy brochure, and essentially when they come to this country, 8 to 9 years down the track, they got told, oh, thank you for your service, but that's all we're going to need from you. It's time for you to move along. People go, what about us? It's kind of felt a betrayal by the government that you lie to us. We didn't have to give up a livelihood back at home or wherever country they come from, but we did so we can build a better future. We helped you build this country, and once we got this country to where you want it, it's time for us to go.
So do you think people in the Chinese community are looking for alternatives at the moment, or do you think that there's a divide there between the rich and the poor, like in most other migrant groups?
There definitely is a huge divide in the rich and poor. There's also a divide between the old and the new. Someone like me, who's been in this country for 20 years, a lot of people I know will go, well, it doesn't affect me, why do I care? Essentially, yeah, I guess that's a huge divide in within the migrant community as well, is that you have the old and the new. And I think a lot of the old migrant has forgotten what it was like to be a new migrant at that time. And I guess the differences we face 20 years ago versus someone who's been here 5, 10 years is very different. Because we know we come to this country with a residency. We come here with skills, and there is a future for us. There's also no future back at home for us, but we know there's a future in New Zealand. And the difference now is there's no more future in New Zealand for these people. And I guess a lot of the older migrants kind of forgot what it's like. They forgot the uncertainty these new migrant faces. It's quite sad that our own community, in a sense, is not standing up for these people as much as I like to see them. Yeah.
I think there's a different kind of argument coming, and it's not from the right, but from the left, that we need to have sustainable migration policies, right? If you like, that we've got infrastructural problems now in Auckland, housing, transport, health. And that migrants who are coming are putting strain on those services, right? Now, the classic left-wing argument when people use migrants as a scapegoat or racists as a scapegoat for housing or employment issues is, well, we need more houses to be built by the government, or we need more investment in transport infrastructure, actually. And that's the problem of politicians and government not doing that, and you're blaming migrants for it. Do you think migrants in Auckland at the minute, and particularly young Chinese workers, are feeling like they're being blamed for the problems that the politicians have created?
Well, definitely I feel like I'm being blamed for something that I I don't believe Chinese people are the causes, or Chinese, Indian, whatever migrate, what country you migrated from are the causes of, especially the housing issues. I'm going to take my neighbour as an example. Last year in November, the house got sold. Previous owner owned it since 1970s. It got sold. You would think it'd been bought up by a migrant because it's now being rented as actually an income property, rental property, etc. All done up very cheap, and they wanted to sell, but it couldn't get sold. And then I found out the owner of this new owner of this property is actually a New Zealander. His family's been in here for generations. How can you blame migrants for driving up house prices and driving up rental prices when the majority of people around you who actually own a lot of these properties are New Zealanders? So we're being used as an scapegoat. It's not us that's been driving up. Yes, you see Chinese people buying up properties and getting rental properties, but how many of these properties are actually been bought up by new migrants? I know many, many Chinese who's been here 20, 30 years. They own majority of the properties. It's not the new ones, it's the older ones as well. So you can't just point the fingers at new migrants and say, it's these people who come to this country within the last 3, 5, 10 years that's driving up the housing prices, because they're not. A lot of these people that come to New Zealand, they used to be students, they worked their butt off to get their degree, pay for the education system in New Zealand, and they work to get everything they have today. They work for their houses. They used to pay the rent. Now they pay a mortgage. They do it just like everyone else. It's those who's been here for a very long time. They have those money saved up. They have the money back at home. They bought the money over from relatives, wherever they get the money from. It's them that's actually driving up the housing prices.
John, do you think there's been a kind of an ugly theme introduced into this election?
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head there, Joe, that this focus on immigrants and immigration, when the problems are very, very clearly economic, is it's a real shortcut of lazy thinking. You know, you can say we don't have enough houses for people, too many people, or not enough houses, too many people, where are they coming from? Let's look around. And it's just, actually, the economics are much more complicated than that. It's been under development, under building, and if you look at the market, it hasn't even acted rationally in the last 20 years. The prices have gone up. So, it's sad. It's lazy and it's sad, and it's playing on people's fear. And I think people should be looking for more positive backings for their policies rather than just getting the cheap, fearful, easy votes.
Do you think the rise of New Zealand First kind of fits in with the kind of economic populism we've seen abroad, Mike?
Sort of a nationalism and chauvinism and pig ignorance, they often do it by posing as an anti-establishment sort of Kant sort of thing. Whereas. Winston Peters came from the National Party. He's Tory old school in terms of conservative right-wing policy, but nationalistic. But like Trump in the far right in France, they have a more nationalistic approach rather than being sort of free market globalized. It's their local capitalists that they want to promote the interests of and use the state as a weapon to promote their interests against the competition from foreign capital. And Winston's a little bit in that category. The immigration stuff he got his initial traction on that when there was a unease around that time of in the mid 90s when there was a significant change in the migration flow away from Europe towards Asia, and point system was introduced, and people were coming here on points, and there was a radical alteration in the demographics that were coming here, and the country as a whole got a little nervous at that time, and Winston made some traction. I think people got more comfortable with immigration. People got a basic understanding that as a rule, New Zealand for decades has lost a significant, around about 1% of its population each year, right? So New Zealand has about a quarter.
There was none of yous here 1,500 years ago.
Yeah.
Sorry, lads. I come from a 30,000-year-old culture.
And
30,000.
And so a quarter of New Zealanders live, New Zealand-born people live overseas, and a quarter of our population in New Zealand was born overseas. We are a creature of the new age of sort of global travel and movement and labour, and in particular the fact that the Australian economy has over almost 20 years done significantly better than New Zealand economy, in part because we shot ourselves in the foot and adopted a right-wing economic and austerity course in the late 80s and early 90s, which Australia didn't do as badly. So we've got a situation where there is and the government has also been using immigration to try to, you know, and they have loosened the immigration inflows to try to sort of add a bit of froth to the economy, you know, with a flow of people in, and
instead of having it flat white,
instead of a serious economic or political strategy to develop the economy, they just hope that more people will produce more economic growth, and to a degree, that's true.
But they're basically fudging the numbers, aren't they, Mike? You let people in, those people engage in any kind of economic activity, and off goes your GDP.
It's growth, but it's not GDP per capita growth, and that's what hasn't been going up. There hasn't been a significant, in fact, there's been a decline in their growth in terms of the per head of population over the last couple of quarters, which is sort of things coming to a head. I think Labor and the Greens have tried to shift back a little bit in their policy announcements of late. Where Labor was talking about reduction of tens of thousands in what seemed like permanent migrant numbers, when they came out with their policy, it actually emphasized the failure of the government to plan for the population growth. So if you read the formal statement, it talks about the failure to plan for, with housing and infrastructure and roading and all the rest of it, and it's the government's responsibility for that. So that was a positive, and they, instead of focusing on permanent migration numbers, they actually were looking at more of the temporary flow that's coming in and out around the students and the temporary work visas. And so that the tens of thousands of reductions in what seemed like permanent migration numbers turned into a few tens of thousands of the temporary visa, student and other visa numbers, which are a quarter of a million a year of these are issued. So a 30,000 reduction of a quarter of a million total is actually a 12% reduction. So it's not, if you know, it's so that...
Yeah, you it's, talked it's, about it's the almost, dishonesty.
So yeah, there's a dishonesty around it, trying to appear to be, we're being decisive.
Hard on migration.
And even New Zealand First has not said what its permanent migration number is.
Well, he was a minister, wasn't he?
Yes. So for 15 or almost 20 years, New Zealand has had a permanent residence number each year of around 40,000, right? And that has not changed. It didn't change when Winston was in government. It was the same under National, the same under Labor. And you actually need that number in order to deal with some of the flow out, which normally happens, to deal with family reunification, to deal with refugees, to deal with the Samoan quota. You've got all these and the skilled migrant categories that they need. No government is proposing a radical reduction in that permanent migration number because they know that they can't. They can't. It's just, it's economic. It would be economically witless to do that. So, they are pretending to do... Now, I believe that actually the national government's policy will have a far more dramatic negative impact on... And they're pretending to be in the alternative to Labor and the Greens and New Zealand First, who they portray as being against migration, they're trying to portray themselves as the friend of the migrants, but the policy which is coming into effect in August is going to have a gigantic, which Shirley was talking about, it's going to have a gigantic impact on people who are here and going to drive people out, it's going to stop people coming, and I think it's going to lead to tens of thousands fewer numbers. Now, they're trying to say, well, that's not our policy, but that's actually their policy, and it's going to have negative impacts. It's going to put people in a more vulnerable position than they've ever been before.
Mike, do you think New Zealand government have a double standard on migrants, like with the rich and the poor? Because we can see, you know, in the last couple of weeks,
they're happy to have various. Now they've worked. See, what the government worked out was that they could do the 40,000 number each year. With a $50,000 income threshold and skills and so on associated with it, right? So university degrees, postgraduate, all the points you get for these various things, and they could do their number. They could do that for 45,000 a year. They could do that number and impose a $49,000 thing in terms of the permanent residence, getting permanent residence. And so it takes away all of the rights of those people or aspirations of all of those people who were in less skilled, less qualified, less sort of positions. And there's tens of thousands of them in this country, but who came here under the old rules and at least had a chance of transitioning from a job in the restaurant industry to permanent residence, from a job in the aged care industry. So there's thousands of Filipino nurses and nurse aides, there's thousands of workers in all of these sectors of the industry who have had their aspirations for permanent residence taken away from them. And the government doesn't care about that because it actually doesn't want them necessarily to transition. It wants a pool of vulnerable, exploitable labour, and it's happy for that to keep churning over and changing. For you know, and so now they impose with their new policy in August a 3-year time limit on anyone who comes in, and they can't bring their partner, and so they're just here to be exploited and abused, and it's appalling. And they need to be exposed.
I went to see this play about a love affair between a Chinese market garden worker and a young Maori field hand. Called Mooncake and the Coomera, and it was in the 19th century in New Zealand at the time when they were going to put a poll tax on Chinese workers.
They did.
And I was just wondering, Shirley, because I mean, I was interested that the play was put on at the current moment in time when, you know, people were talking about Chinese surnames, you know, people buying houses, and like that was a party of the left that was criticising people on that. I mean, do Chinese workers now, because we've met a couple of chefs who are facing this crisis in August, they've worked, they've done all the things, and like, do you think this is kind of like a Chinese poll tax moment? Now, in the 21st century, a lot of Chinese workers going, this place just doesn't respect us.
I don't think it's more the toll tax. It feels more like what Hitler was doing to the Jews back in the 1930s, essentially. Thank you for building our country, but off you go. We're done with you. And that's it. That's what I feel like. It's quite different from the poll tax, whereas tax, they just refuse us from living, whereas does they give you that false hope that you might be able to build a future, but in reality there's no future for you. So it's a bit different. I think I would say the way the government is doing things now, we call it modern day slavery. You're here for a temporary time, thank you for your service, thank you for ruining your health. They give their health, their life, their family up for this country, and once they're done with them, off you go, see you later, you're no longer our responsibility and our problem. That's how
I feel. Not allowed. Under the new scheme, once you've done your 3 years labouring, you're not allowed to even renew that visa, even if you're wanted, right? Unless you can guarantee a sort of a $50,000 salary and a blah, 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 get some other points. You have to leave for a year before you can apply again. Now, And you can't bring partners, which... now, these rules, which they had them in Canada until recently, but they've changed them in Canada because they were so abusive of people who were coming. It's just not fair on people who come there and start their new lives. And inevitably, they meet people, they fall in love, they create relationships, they become part of other people's families. And yet the government wants to treat them like they're simply a labour unit to be used and abused.
I think one great example is a chef we met at one of the work sites we take care of. He was saying that he came to this country when he was 20 years old. He's now 29. He has to go back home to China. When you're in your 20s, especially when you come from a country that is so fast speed and it's who you know, not what you know. It's all the connection that you built. You spent your 20s building those connections. And it's that time that you establish yourself and build an empire for yourself. Now, he spent that 9 years of his life, that building, the foundation building time in New Zealand, hoping to build a future. Now, when he goes back, who would hire a 30-year-old in a fast-speed country where there's, you know, things change within minutes, hours, it's different every day. Who would hire a 30-year-old with no work experience and no connections?
I was at a meeting with you with migrant workers who had the planned protests during the election period at some of these politicians. Do you think Chinese workers will be joining like the Indian workers did?
I certainly hope so because there's, you know, I always think we are stronger as Chinese as a whole. And other times, if we look past in the last 20 years, Chinese people have stand up together and fought for our right, especially when it comes to immigration issues. I remember growing up, correct me if I'm wrong, in the 2000s, we did a massive protest because a lot of people missed out on the residency in New Zealand. And I remember... I don't remember the
exact... Was that in Aotea Square?
I think that was the Aotea Square where they did the massive hunger strike. We did it once upon a time where we were a lot weaker, and I believe Chinese people would do it again, especially now that we have the backings from the Chinese government. A very little things that we did around Unite and the Sky City, we got podcasts on CCTV4. I mean, Julia and myself, we got interviewed by a Chinese television. Only a few million people watches that on a daily basis. So, you know...
200 million?
Something like that. Not that many, but you can see that, you know, people in China are also worried about that as well because they've invested in a family member, hoping that they would have a better future. Parents has invested a lot of money. I mean, average income from where I'm from is $3,000 a month. And some of these school fees is, 50,000 New Zealand a year. That's a lot of money that the parents has, whether they borrowed, worked 2-3 jobs to support these children. So they would care.
Well, the anger's real. We've met them. And John, yeah, I'm coming back to your birthday and a request you might want to make. But when a crazy boss pushes the workers too hard, what could happen on that farm?
Indeed. Yeah, I see where you're going with this. So this was my request for this show. It's very easy, I think, to pick Rage Against the Machine for a political line. But this is off the album of covers that they did, and the song was originally written by Bob Dylan. So this is Rage Against the Machine's version of Maggie's Farm.
Ain't gonna work Meg's Farm no more!
Floor. when he puts his cigars out in your face just for kicks. His bedroom window, it is made out of bricks. The National Guard stands around his door.
Well, I worked at Maggie's Farm when Maggie Thatcher ran England, and oh my God, it was a stead. I got out of there just a month before the poll tax riot.
Hey, I have nothing against that. They gave us Hong Kong back.
They still haven't given us Ireland back.
One step at a time.
But I mean, there has been a return of an opposition in Britain as of late. Michael, you've been paying attention to the onward progress of our friends Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell.
Yeah. What's become apparent is that clear policies, which the British Labour Party put up for the election, clear policies, and left-wing policies
Socialist policies.
Socialist policies are able to get...
You don't need to whisper its name anymore.
Able to get majority support in the country. There was a theory that you went after the centre if you wanted to be successful. This was promoted by Tony Blair and the British Labour Party at that time, and in New Zealand by Helen Clark and the Clintons in the United States. What becomes very apparent, though, after a period of time, is that the centre essentially evaporates, and actually the big majority of people are on the left when they're surveyed in terms of their attitude. They want to, including in the United Kingdom, for example, a majority of people want the renationalisation of the rail network. In fact, a majority of Conservative Party voters, when polled separately, want to renationalise the British Rail Service.
That's because the other one isn't working.
A very clear majority of people in the United States want a national health service. It's something close to 60%. No one puts it forward because it's considered too far left wing. That's a socialistic policy. But when people are polled on it, a big majority of people are in favour of it. So parties and individuals who campaign for genuine left socialist policies can win majority support, and if you keep chasing the centre, you'll end up with nothing. I think you end up with no policy, no difference between you and the other. People stop voting, people give up and go home. Whereas in the United Kingdom, and when Bernie Sanders was running in the Democratic Party, people were inspired and joined the political campaigns in the tens and hundreds of thousands, actually, joined the British Labour Party, and millions more registered to vote because they had something to vote for. That's what the New Zealand Labour Party needs to wake up and because their strategy has been to capture the centre. It's failed. They have not lifted themselves an inch in the polls, and if they're going to do it over the next 9 weeks, they need to throw away, dismiss, sack all those people who have been advising the centrist strategy and engage a group of people who have got something different to offer, who are able to inspire people with what they've got to offer. Well, it's not happening now, and Labour has been stuck.
John and Shirley, when you see the rise of kind of left-wing policies, socialism abroad, do you kind of look at New Zealand? Do you think it could happen here?
I cross my fingers and hope it does. It's been very inspiring to watch. You know, obviously, Bernie Sanders first, and then more recently, Jeremy Corbyn. It's been amazing. And to see that level of engagement is also inspiring. I would like to put something to Mike, though. I read a comment, and while I absolutely agree with Mike, what he's just said, I thought it was a very interesting counterpoint, and it said that recently the current Labour government is actually looking back 3 years ago, where they tried to move to the left. We campaigned on the back of the minimum wage rise, among some other things, and that actually handed them their worst defeat ever. So while I think Mike's right, when you look at the 90s, you know, when you look at Tony Blair and the Clintons, you can obviously see the lesson there. But what about that more recent lesson, Mike?
Yeah, that was interesting because the problem you had with the election, I think it was the 2011 election when Phil Goff was leader, and they didn't put his picture up because he was people didn't want him, but they did have some quite left wing policies on the billboards, right? At least
$15 an hour
and
wage.
The problem was no one believed them. Who could believe that Phil Goff was a genuinely left-wing person? The difference between Jeremy Corbyn was, Jeremy Corbyn had been a left-wing campaigner for 4 decades before he became...
So he had the credibility.
Before he became leader. And when he became leader, and when they announced their policy, people believed they were going to introduce that policy. No one in a million miles believed that Phil Goff was going to introduce any left-wing program, whatever they said in the election. In fact, it seemed dishonest to me, and I think most people saw it that way as well. So you've got to have more than the policy, the formal what's on paper. You've got to have the policy and a belief that you are deadly serious about bringing it about.
So where do they sit today then? If we look at Labor and its leadership, you've got Andrew Little, who's obviously a long-time union boss.
Union boss.
Formerly union lawyer. Do you think they have the credibility today?
What went wrong, John, when the lawyers got control of the Labor movement?
I think there's a chance of recovering, right? I think I don't think that the... I think if they had a shift in policy, I think there's a chance Little could front it, right? There's a, and because a little bit he's a bit of an unknown. I think Little will do better in the formal debates. I think he will come across better, even better than English and so on. People will be a little bit surprised. He's a competent debater, and he gives a competent speech. And I've seen him do the stump stuff in workers' meetings and get quite strong support.
In a way, in your blog, you argued that he probably has more charisma than
in
Jeremy
some ways,
Corbyn.
In some ways, Corbyn, yeah. Corbyn's quite
a humble, shy kind of person.
And often awkward in some of his mannerisms and sort of presentation. But Corbyn can turn up at a rock festival and be treated like a rock star now because people do actually know who he is, what he is, and they know what a ferocious sort of campaign to destroy him happened from the British press and so on, and he stood strong through it, and so he appeared a man of principle and a man of genuineness, right? There's a genuineness that has gained traction and things. There's a chance, there's still a chance because he's a relatively unknown.
Authenticity, Michael? Yeah, authenticity
I think there's a chance for Little to do that, but he actually needs a policy. You see, when you announce a policy that says, oh, we're in favour of free tertiary education, I'll give you 1 year in the first 3 years, and then I'll give you another year in the second 3 years, and then I'll give you another year in the third 3 years.
What do we want? Gradual change. Why do we want it? In due course.
And similarly with the tax thing, when you sort of... The reason they get trapped on the taxing because he won't announce any wealth taxes. He won't announce, that the only way you can significantly change the tax system in this country is to go after accumulated wealth. Mm-hmm. People would love it, people would love it, but he says nothing on it.
All right, on that happy note, we leave you. This is probably one of our last broadcasts before the election, but I'd like to thank Shirley, John and Mike for the contributions. And here's a little song from The Clash to go out with for Jeremy Corbyn, The English Civil War.
But John
and
Martin, home again, hurrah.